This is the Skies Blue Podcast. Beginning of year podcast from the Sky is Blue team. That's me, Phil Tooley, Paul Fisher, Stuart Basson and Daryl Carpenter. And we're doing a bit of a sports personality of the year review back of 2022. Right back to days that seem so long ago, we can hardly remember them. The days of James Rowe in charge and Chelsea and everything along those lines. But of course, 2022 started a little bit quieter than that with a New Year's Day home victory against King's Lynn Town, the mighty King's Lynn, with Mandeville scoring. And, well, I have to say, Paul, all in all, it's so memorable, that game, I can't remember it.
Well, I think they didn't have a shot on goal. We scored with our only one on target, which was deflected past the goalkeeper. So there's a question there. I seem to remember Shimanga had an effort towards the back end. Maybe the goalkeeper made a save, I think, but other than that, it was the most unmemorable 3 points that I think that Chesterfield got to cap off the start of the new season. 6,000 odd, and I think we weren't allowed to speak about Chelsea until after the game. And that's when we sort of did a bit in the press. But it was an unremarkable 3 points. But I do also remember that we played a day before everybody else because they were supposed to play on the bank holiday Monday, I think it was, or something. But we just brought the game to the New Year's Day, expecting a bigger crowd than what be on the whatever the next day
yeah,
was.
The proper officially bank holiday type of thing.
Yeah, because they hadn't played on Boxing Day, so they had a New Year's Day game.
Yeah, we were the odd team on Boxing Day. It wasn't postponed or anything. We're 23 teams in. We just missed out. 6,328 the crowd was, which wasn't too bad. But of course, this season the numbers have been phenomenal, really. So yeah, and after that, King's Lynn, of course, we then got tonked in the next game, but had one of the greatest days of modern days. Daryl at Chelsea, having earned the tie by doing pretty well in the earlier rounds. And once that tie was pulled out pretty early in the draw, I seem to remember, Chelsea against Chesterfield, all of a sudden everybody's attention turned to there. And initially we thought, well, we might have a chance because they might play their kids. And they didn't.
No. I remember sat on the bus and their team filtered through. And we all thought, oh dear, it could be a long afternoon, this. Let's hope we come out of here without being embarrassed. And I don't think we were embarrassed, in all honesty. We gave a good account of ourselves, and the goal, as much as it was a consolation and wound up one or two of our opposition supporters, was celebrated quite rightly as being a moral victory under the circumstances. So, memorable day.
And just what was the atmosphere like amongst that 6,000 at Stamford Bridge, Daryl? Yeah, I was in the press area watching it, but not feeling it.
It was pretty special. I mean, we never stopped cheering the entire game. Even when they scored, I think we actually got louder each time. It was phenomenal support to see young and old, and I mean, it was literally kids to granddads and grandmas, stood side by side, loving every minute of it, just proud to be from the town, representing the town on a big stage like that. And it was a feeling that'll live long in the memory. It will.
And the second half, Stuart, of course, it was 4-0 at half time, so we drew the second half.
We scored did.
That late goal from Kwasi Asante, but hey, we held the European champions to a draw.
Well, yeah, we made certain changes at half time, didn't we? One of the two of our players, to me, appeared to be a bit kind of stage struck, if you like. But, you know, taken by the occasion, and Chelsea raced into that lead. But second half, we made some changes, and I dare say they made a load of changes too, which probably made them less effective. But it, if the first half had been as competitive as the second half, then, you know, we might have had more than just a consolation goal to talk about at the end of it. Yeah.
Yeah, they might have made a couple of changes. They took Lukaku and Kovacic off, but they did bring Havertz on and Loftus-Cheek. So, you know, it wasn't a bad swap for them. You weren't immediately thinking, my word, should be a pushover now.
No, I was just a bit disappointed that we didn't hang around at the end and say to them, some of these subs you've got that can't get in your first team, have you thought about letting them go on loan?
Yeah.
You know, so.
I just remember Jeff King was a bit starstruck, as Stuart said. He was up against Callum Hudson-Odoi, I think, in the first half on the left-hand side, and he ripped him to shreds, I think, as well. And there was a bit when, I think it was Ziyech. Did Ziyech play? I remember did the 11 for Chelsea.
Yeah, Ziyech played all 90 minutes and scored the penalty.
And he went past Fraser Kerr like a knife through butter, didn't he? And Kerr was trying to hack him down, wasn't he, at once? I think it was for the first goal or maybe the second goal or something like that. But he just thought, my word, looking at the side on, these players are just like lightning. They were just incredibly pacey. It's nothing like that we get to see week in, week out. Nothing at all. Nothing can compare to it unless you see it on a regular basis. But it was just scary how quick they are. It's just immense.
And our
really,
position, Paul, our position in the press area, we were right in it, weren't we? We were only 7 or 8 yards away from the touchline, really low down. So our sitting down position was almost head height of a player running on the park. So you felt part of it. Like you say, from that side on, the speed, you could even see the speed of thought, couldn't you, as well as the speed in feet.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Right. It was just... just a pleasure to be there, you know, in many respects to watch it. It's just a shame it was against your side, you know what I mean, that you'd gone to sort of cover and everything. But you wanted something, and Kwasi Asante gave that. But, I mean, the game was over after half an hour, wasn't it, in the 3-0 down, you know, the fourth goal being scored just before half-time, then the fifth just after in the second half. And then it sort of... weirdly, Chesswell seemed to get better when Gavin Gunning went off. I don't know if there was any coincidence or anything, but yeah, he was brought into the side. But anyway, and I'm pleased that there Chesswell got a goal and in front of the Chesswell supporters as well. It meant a lot. There were some naysayers from the Chesswell end, some that report on TalkSport from the Chelsea end that talk on TalkSport about it being a bit embarrassing. But so what?
I don't think it's embarrassing, was it? A National League side goes to a team 4 or 5 divisions above a European.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, when I was talking to Kwasi Asante immediately after the match and told him he was the first non-league player to score on that park for 100 years, he was not upset.
Exactly. Whoever it was, I can't remember what TalkSport presenter it was, but... just they've got no thought other than Chelsea, and this know I mean that's obviously their idea, and they've got no idea that there are other clubs
that, if they thought that was in any way embarrassing for us, what is it like for the other Premiership teams who went there that season and lose by rather more than 5-1?
Well, exactly.
I'll tell you what the players thought about it. I was at the youngsters Christmas party a day or two ago, and Joe Quigley and Jamie Grimes were answering all of the normal questions that you get from the youngsters. Who's your favourite Avenger? And, you know, things along those lines.
Diana Reed.
One of the questions was, you know, which is your favourite ground that you played on? And both of those players have played at Wembley. Jamie Grimes played in the FA Trophy final for Hereford against Hornchurch. And I must admit, I was surprised when Joe Quigley said he played at Wembley, because I'd missed that. but he played for Boreham Wood against Tranmere in the playoff final in the year that Tranmere replaced us in the EFL. And and you know, I sort of said to James, obviously Wembley must have been one of your must have been perhaps the best ground that you've done. And he talked about that. He said, and then of course there was Chelsea. So it just showed you how much the players enjoyed it. He came on for Gunning after an hour or so, and that's in his psyche has been one of the great days of his career. So that's 5-1, good, yeah. Irrelevant.
I think so.
Yeah, and we carried that form into London a week later, North London this time with a 4-1 win. Barnett, Gabby Shimanga scoring two goals, and they became the last player to score two goals for Chesterfield in an away match until Joe Quigley against Scunthorpe United on the last match of 2022. So there you go. First and last National League matches. The only two times Chesterfield have had a player get a brace in an away game. Nice little bit of bookending. I quite like that. That was, Paul, just a totally and utterly dominant second half. It was, you know, all square at half time, but an out of the traps like nobody's business in the second half, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was clinical, wasn't it? They threatened in the first half. They've been the better side. They had good moments, Barnett. They were threatening to sort of be because they started this season well, didn't they? That you could see sort of signs of that with Rob Hall being a key feature for them. And, you know, Dean Brennan's a good manager, in my opinion. But they were blown away in the second half. Chesterfield really, really played well and moved up another gear to try and take the game. And it's just a shame that Barnett scored in the end. It was a bitterly cold day, wasn't it? Open ground. And yeah, but thoroughly deserved the 3 points. And, you know, from that game, thought that Chesterfield would go on to make inroads into the, you know, getting promoted, but as we know, things changed.
Well, of course, what happened next, Stuart, was, it's become pretty traditional, hasn't it, over the years. Maidenhead, who always know how to really sort of stop you thinking that things are going quite well. 3-2 defeat there, and it had looked at one stage as though Chester were going to dominate. Kelly and Sparks, who always seem to play well against Chesterfield, and put Maidenhead two up. And then King and Shimanga relatively early in the second half. King at the end of the first half, Shimanga 10 minutes into the second half, had levelled things up. And there were only one winner from there, but it was Maidenhead. And we didn't think that was what it was going to be with Kelly with another game. And that's when clearly things were shown not to be right, Stu.
Yeah, absolutely. That I think that was when the fact that the wheels were going to fall off became more public, wasn't it? I mean, to a certain extent, that might have been covered up by the fact, as you said earlier, that it's almost a tradition now that we go to Maidenhead and play poorly, whoever the manager is and whatever the 11 players are. But no, that was the point at which, for me, you know, all the talk of things not being right behind the scenes suddenly sort of materialised in the performance on the pitch, as poor as it was, really. And just afterwards, of course, the social media got hold of someone assumed to be the manager having a sort of shouting uncomplimentary things, what can we call it, at one of our players, we thought, you know, and that kind of suggested that all was not well off the field between the management and the players. And I think we probably all began to fear, you know, for the worst at that time, even though I think we were still top of the league, weren't we, after that defeat? Oh, no, we were second. Yeah.
Yeah. Whether you can call it Dweebgate or Nosegate or something like that, but it was certainly the exit gate was starting to open.
Yeah, there were too many unsavoury rumours going round about things behind the scenes. The word that we used to me quite often at that time was that there seemed to be that the manager had lost some, if not all, parts of the dressing room. And it had really started, to be honest, a little earlier than that, when we'd had a load of injuries in the autumn. And we were struggling to string results together after that fantastic start. And he seemed to be prone for picking out on individuals and making them scapegoats. Things clearly weren't right. I don't think we were playing anywhere near, for instance, either the style or the way we had done in the first sort of third of the season. And he was making excuses. Was it the Halifax game at home where the pitch had not been very good? And he was moaning like Billy O that we can't play football. We're having to hoof it because the pitch isn't very good. And of course, it all came out in the wash afterwards that the reason the pitch wasn't very good was he was training on it 5 days a week, despite being told by the groundsman not to. So there were all these things knocking about. Then, as you say, Dweeb or Nosegate or whatever you want to call it, Maidenhead, hit social media, and these things don't stay quiet for very long. In this modern age, it was different when all us four were growing up. Things stayed behind closed doors a lot more, didn't they? And there were Chinese whispers, anything like that now gets out. And then, of course, on top of all that was the revelation that he was going to be suspended, and I don't think at the time anyone was quite sure why when it first came to light.
That came after the Aldershot match, which was at home the week after, 0-0 draw, and of course, you know, Daz just touched on the pitch, Paul, there as well, and around in that time, and I think almost an Unro-like signing of Joe Quigley seemed to be, we've got to play it differently, so you need to have a different player in the style of Quigley and everything along those lines to play a more long game. And in that sort of time, it just, again, that just didn't feel right. Joe Quigley played for 83 minutes against Aldershot in that 0-0, and you could see the change of style in that game, couldn't you?
Yeah, you certainly could. You know, he'd done well for Yeovil the start of the season, but I didn't think he was necessarily a Chesterfield signing for the way that Chesterfield had been playing. It seemed really out of character for that, and now you can see why, because of the pitch, because they wanted a plan B. It was a very expensive plan B signing, though, I'll hasten to add, isn't he? So, you know.
And one of the other ironies of it, Paul, was it came at a time when Denton was just getting fit again.
Yes, that was the weird thing, because I think he came on a sub, did he? Or he was there or thereabouts, wasn't he?
In that Aldershot game, yeah.
Yeah, so it was there or thereabouts that he was getting ready to play. It was a bit of a strange one, but in actual fact, as it's worked out in the future, it's to the benefit of Joe Quigley. So, but obviously at that time, he was not number one target that Chesterfield supporters were naming as the possible new signing that James Rowe was going to make. So,
yes, absolutely, and so there's things still going on about the Rowe exit, which means that we can't really sort of talk about that. We've all got our own views. We all know a bit of tickle tackle, but you know, we don't want to start upsetting anything that might play into the hands of the courts that'll hear the full stories, whatever they are, accordingly. But you know, what did seem to happen, Stuart, was that everybody seemed to rally around the trust and the board and saying, well, they're not going to get rid of a manager at the top of the league unless there's some rationale to do it. And it almost seemed to bring everybody into a position where they thought, well, OK, I don't understand it, but hey, that's a tough decision to make. And if it's right, well done.
No, you summed that up perfectly, Phil. I mean, you think of times past when somebody had got rid of a successful manager halfway through a successful season, you know, the board would have been lynched, wouldn't they? But there was there was still, and there is still, of course, a greater sort of trust in the trust, in their motives and in their abilities, much more than for any sort of many recent chairmen that we've had. And that trust, as you say, was maintained throughout that whole horrible period. I think it helped tremendously that they, you know, put a little bit of faith in the assistant, in Danny Webb, until such time as the thing got sorted out. And he responded brilliantly, didn't he? Behaved with such great sort of dignity and composure throughout the whole time, you know. And the grapevine being what it is, rumours about what had caused the suspension were getting out. And I think all of that put together just sort of strengthened the bond, if you like, that between the supporters and the trust, and led everyone to continue to have faith in the trust's governance of the football club. Yeah.
And Darrell, what happened as well, Danny Webb there, he'd been at Chesterfield, he'd been, you know, very much a part of behind the scenes. James Rowe clearly ran the ship, and he'd been sort of quite quiet in the background. But in those three games that he took charge, Eastleigh away 1-1, Dagenham and Redbridge at home 1-2-1, and in Stockport, which we'll talk about shortly, the 2-2 draw, he catapulted himself into a whole different stratosphere of respect from the Chesterfield fans, didn't he?
Yes, which has continued, I have to say, to this day. I know Cookie has this mad superstition at the minute that he only talks to you. I won't talk to Paul at all, but that's another subject. But only talks to you when we lose. So I don't want to hear from him, personally. Mm-hmm. And I quite like Danny. I think he gives a really honest appraisal of the game. I like his pre-match stuff. It's very light-hearted, but it clearly shows that he's a big influence behind the scenes. I suspect has got an awful lot of respect from the players as well as the supporters, and I know he's very highly thought of by the board as well.
And you know, he seems to be one of the people that say the right things, but he says the right things because he means it, as opposed to saying the right things because he knows the right things to say. He seems to say, and yeah, he seems to have settled in the area. He's found a partner in the area. He's happy to talk to people about town when he's out there, either having a beer or walking the dog or something along those lines. Paul, he just seems to have found a home in terms of a town and a home in terms of a job and club.
He has a quick plug for the club's podcast. Who are you? Danny Webb episode is an excellent one to listen to. Very good. And you mentioned about the fact that he's found a home. You know, he's got, I think does he drink in the barrel? Is it on Chatsworth Road? I think something like that.
Is it? I think that's a law. You've got to.
Okay. So he goes in that, and there's another pub as well, Britannia, I think, something like that. Anyway, in the, he does, and he's an easygoing guy. I'm sure if he does get furious with a player, it'll be with a sort of wry smile, book your ideas up type of thing. Mm-hmm. He's always good to have a chat with. It's always nice to, even if you're not, you know, having an on-air conversation, he'll always chat to you off-air as well. Mm-hmm. And he's the perfect foil for the previous two managers, of course. He's the alter manager, if you will. And I like the fact that he's a fabric of the side, and it was important. I know we're coming up to the Weymouth game when Cook was appointed, but it was important. I did an interview with Mike Goodwin that he mentioned that Danny Webb was given an extended contract at the same time, so to stay with the club, and I think that was emphasized pretty quickly.
Yeah, no, as we were talking about for the suspension, I knew, because I'd been told you don't go then and shout out that any new manager coming in, one of the conditions was, well, you keep Danny Webber. Danny Webb's not going anywhere, and that's that continuity element. And if you want a manager in who says, well, no, I want to bring my own people in, it would have been, well, you're not going to get the job then. So the board really dug the heels in. I don't think they had to deal the heels in as it came out, but they were prepared to, and that's what they would have done. And that Eastleigh match, of course, it was televised, wasn't it, in a pretty poor game until that absolutely phenomenal goal from Curtis Weston right at the end. And Danny Webb's dad, Dave, former Chelsea player, was there. And before he went and did any interviews, he had a good long chat with his dad. And a really emotional moment for him. And I'm not surprised, really, because, you know, when you're thrust into a position that you were never expecting to, and then you're looking at it and think it's not going well, this, and then you have that absolutely unbelievable goal at the time, and in the time it was, it had been an unbelievable goal in the 35th minute, but an unbelievable goal right at the end. Adds to it.
I think, Phil, if I'm right, that his grandfather had passed away pretty recently that particular point.
A few days before that. Yes. Yeah. You're absolutely right. So, yeah, great emotional moment. Then, of course, it was going a little bit off the rails in the next match against Dagenham and Redbridge, 1-0 down. And it took a couple of cabbie penalties to give Chesterfield the points in that match. But again, you know, people were looking at Danny and he was starting to get the sort of notice, really, Daryl, that people were thinking, yeah, he's a continuity candidate, give it him.
Yeah, which is quite rare, isn't it? A number of times these things happen with managers and they're supposed to say, oh, we don't want the cheap option. We want fresh blood, or we want this and we want that. But I think there was a groundswell of opinion to say, you know, keep the hand on the tiller. I don't think at that stage any deal had been done with James Rowe for him to actually leave either. I think we were still in limbo land, weren't we?
Yes, definitely.
So it was a really difficult time, both for the club, for Danny, I'm sure for all the players. The supporters were a little bit, what the hell's going on? We've got the best chance of going up since we got into the National League, and suddenly it's all falling apart around our ears, kind of thing. And he gave you a little bit of something to cling on to during the madness of that 3 or 4 weeks that we were going through, and kept results going as well, more to the point.
The biggest irony of all, though, Daryl, was that his status to legend came after we chucked a two-goal lead away and only drew.
I mean, that was a cracking night at Stockport. I mean, the atmosphere was electric, wasn't it? Walking to the ground, to an old style ground with the lights on, there was a buzz in the air from both sets of supporters. They knew what was on the line. They were on this terrific run. We got all the problems in the world, and for an hour played them off the park, didn't we? I mean, we were two up. You could only see one winner until Jeff King got sent off. And I know, again, they pull our legs about saying, oh, well, you were 2-0 and you threw it away. I don't think they'd have got anywhere near beating us or getting a point that night had we stayed 11 versus 11. We were terrific. But the way we dug in as a team, having gone down and then conceded the two quick goals, I mean, you were odds on to lose that match. So it was a point gained as far as I was concerned under the circumstances. Yeah.
And, of course, the way the game went, sorry, Phil.
There was still 25 assisted minutes to go at 2-2, wasn't there?
Yeah.
And the way the game went kind of assisted the Danny Webb legend narrative, if you like, didn't it? Because the 11 that he chose were 2-0 up. And it was only when one of them managed to get himself sent off, you know, that the control of the game slipped away from us a bit, you know? So his team had still gone there and performed ever so well. And
well, I didn't have a good night.
If you're going to blame anyone, people might have blamed King for. Anyway.
I didn't have a good night at all. I was supposed to do a commentary with Drew Talbot. BBC Radio Manchester are supposed to have had this, or Stockport are supposed to have this ISDN point in. I tried every single blooming connection to try and get in. Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And we couldn't do commentary. And I was absolutely gutted. And we even threw away a 2-0 blooming lead and had a man sent off as well. So I had a bad night.
I remember. And we've not all been there, but I've been there. So I know exactly how you you felt ball, and we were all trying to help each other out, weren't we? And it just wasn't to be. But 10,000 plus crowd that day. Let's say 25 minutes of time, and Stockport really turned up the pressure, but couldn't score again. And that 2-0 lead thrown away was the reaction at the end. Stuart said it all. Chesterfield, as though they'd just won the European Cup, and Stockport, having come from 2-0 down, were on the floor as if they'd been relegated from whatever,
They're funny games, aren't they, where you are under the cosh for a bit and you come away with something, and it does feel, you do feel like the winning team, and moral victories and all of that, I suppose.
Yes.
And for all their pressure, and for all the talk and everything, they couldn't beat us, even with 10 men,
Yeah, and there have been rumours, Daz, for a while that Paul Cook had been approached and he turned it down and all that sort of stuff, and wanted to bring 63 people with him and all sorts of bits and bobs. And then, a little bit before the long trip down to Weymouth, all of a sudden Cookie's return is... It is confirmed, and initially it was just him, wasn't it? There was nobody else coming through the threshold at that particular time. Gary Roberts, of course, came some time later. And whilst everybody recognised what a great job he'd done before, there were plenty of doubters who thought, well, he doesn't really know this level of football. It's not the right move for him at this time. Blah 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 blah. But as soon as we saw Paul Cook at Weymouth, and I chatted with him before he went into the ground when he first arrived, I could tell straight away he was up for this. And I knew after he left in 2015, that he knew he'd got unfinished business here. So it's just one of those. It's a little bit Keith Hill, Rochdale sort of thing. He just feels at home here for whatever reason. I don't know, but he does.
Yeah, he'd made it fairly clear, hadn't he, in his interview with Nick after he'd taken the job, that he felt there was unfinished business. He'd also said he'd not enjoyed management over the previous 2 or 3 years, all the goings on financially at Wigan and all the fallout of that. And then he'd gone to Ipswich, been promised certain things, and then found the club sold from under him. And I think a lot of promises that had been made to him weren't kept. And then he was only given, 13 or 14 games or something daft, having changed most of the team in the summer. So, he looked like a man that was, as you say, looking for familiarity, looking for a home where he knew he would be loved and appreciated, and he knew the people that he was working for, and he knew the supporter base. And as you've said, Phil, he also, and I think quite genuinely, feels it was unfinished business for him. I don't think he ever envisaged he would be coming back under the circumstances in which he did, because you don't very often get the chance to take over a team in the top two or three in the division, do you? But there were a lot of underlying issues, and of course it all crystallised on that day at Weymouth, because once we'd lost Cabby, I think we'd almost written off the season at that point, because we were just so reliant on him.
Yeah, I've just looked, and I hadn't realised it was quite as late in the game as it was. It's down as 87. Now, that'll have been the time that the substitute came on, and obviously Cabby was being treated for 5 or 6 or more minutes. So, but I hadn't realised it was quite as late as that. Chesterfield were 1-0 up. Alex Whittle had scored the goal. Ross Fitzsimons was playing in goal for Weymouth and had a blinder, didn't he?
He certainly did.
To be fair, by the time Cabby was injured, we should have been home and dry, but it was only 1-0. And we obviously didn't know what was what the immediate issue was, but as you and I, Paul, sitting up in the main stand right at the back, and you could see for quite a long time, and we could see the ambulance coming on full blues, and you think, all right, okay, there is something properly wrong here.
Yeah.
And whilst I think he did come back to Chesterfield that night, and we soon found out that he'd obviously broken his leg and dislocated his ankle or whatever it was, quite rightly, Paul, people were thinking, my word, with the greatest respect to Joe Quigley, he's not going to replace the goal a game man of the moment in the National League. It was so far ahead of everybody else in the scoring charts. I think he was still leading scorer till about three games before the end, wasn't he?
Yeah.
And it was one of those red letter moments, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll tell you how late in the game it was. I managed to get about 5 minutes worth of commentary at the back end of a six-team show on Radio Sheffield in Football Heaven. So that's how late that it had gone on into the incident for Cabbie Chemanga. I mean, as soon as the challenge that came in, you could see Manoah running in from a distance to try and nail him here. And I know that Manoah's won the ball, but the fact that he's gone through Chemanga as well, just straight away, I just thought, and Chemanga, an interview I did with him again after the Barnet game earlier on this season, he said he didn't know that he'd broken his leg. He tried to get up from that incident and then saw that his ankle was facing the other way and whatnot. And then it was a bit of a shock. And yeah, it was just heartbreaking because, you know, the feeling had been good. Chesterfield took a lot of supports down because it was Weymouth, you know, gone for the weekend and whatnot. Paul Cook arriving, and we'd had all the build up with that, with the club putting out an excellent sort of teaser as well from, I think it was Bron that did it, Bron Jenkinson, and we'd had all that as well, and Cook coming, Chesterfield taking the lead through Whittle, deservedly so, looking like they were going to go on and get 3 points, and then bang, one change. It's a huge key moment in the rest of the season. And from then on, yeah. Fraser Kerr's mistake for their equaliser, 96 minute or whatever it was. And you could sense a lot of air being sucked out of just about everybody involved with Chesterfield. If it hadn't happened before with the Maidenhead game, this was a you were there moment, or you know, you heard it, or you know about it moment that was going to cost Chesterfield promotion.
Yeah, and the next couple of games, Daz, really sort of put the nail in the coffin, wasn't it? 2-0 up, cruising Solihull. Then what was Western stupid, or was the referee conned? We can argue the toss about that for ages, but from 2-0 up, comfortable, man down, losing 3-0 to Solihull, and then Wrexham at home on that Tuesday night in February. Absolutely sublime Paul Cook football in the first half, but we all knew at half time at 0-0 that Wrexham can't be that bad in the second half. And of course, they came out and did what Wrexham do and got a couple of goals. Ollie Palmer with them both in familiar style for Wrexham. And you thought, well, you know, it's going south from here, isn't it? And despite the fact that both games should have been won.
Yeah, I think you're right, Phil. I mean, I think Paul's expression there, the air being sucked out, is absolutely right. And bearing in mind, Cookie was still getting used to the players, who was fit, because we still had a lot of other injuries besides Cabbie. He found a formation that started off like lightning against Solihull, were in complete charge, 2-0 up. And then, you know, say what you like, it was more than cute. The referee was appalling on the day, wasn't he? Let's be honest, because there was the tackle later on McCourt as well that he missed, wasn't he? And gave nothing for. And you walk away from that, I mean, lost 3-2, and you think, oh, God almighty. And then on a Tuesday night, we come out and batter Wreck, absolutely batter him. And Rob Laynton saves everything in that first half.
Stunning he was.
Best goalkeeping performance I've seen in the National League.
Yeah.
And we also missed some sitters on top of him playing out of his skin. And like you said, he got to half-time and you're just thinking, with their set-piece prowess from long throws and whatever, they're bound to get an opportunity. And of course they did, didn't they? Second one, clearly handball. And you just thought, nothing's going for us here. We've lost the manager, top of the league. Cabbie's got crocked. We threw away 3 points against Solihull, and now we've done the same against Wrexham. And I think we all, in our heart of hearts, knew any challenge for automatic had gone at that point. And staying in the playoffs, as it lay to prove, would be a struggle.
Soon turn around, Stuart, in terms of it was a poor game against Yeovil, but a cracker of a goal from Jim Kellerman to beat Yeovil 1-0. And then COVID hit me, so I wasn't at the excellent showing against Notts County when Lawrence Maguire's day in that 3-1 victory. All of a sudden, you think it's going. Then Southend at home, 1-1. Then Miller scored relatively late to make it 2-1. Paul Cook made a change, brought Fraser Kerwood, made that error at Weymouth, on to shore it up. I think, who did he come on? He came on for a midfielder, I think. 87 minutes came on for Miller. Yep. Mm. So a centre-half for an attacking left-sider. And, of course, scooped in for his last gap, wasn't it? And at that point, I think, all right, okay. Hmm.
Just everything you seemed to try to do to swing the game your way actually swung it away from you, didn't you, around that sort of time? The Notts performance was tremendous, I thought. And we went to Boreham Wood, didn't we, late goal from Asante that we couldn't hold on to a lead for. That was becoming a bit of a characteristic. But we should have beaten Boreham Wood on the balance of play.
Giant Clifton, who came off the bench, just battered his way around the far post from a free kick or a corner, wasn't it, to equalise for Boreham Wood 88. But we'll not talk about the game much because it was another not great game. But we actually did meet Maidenhead in the match.
First time ever.
I know. And then all of a sudden we had a run of, let me just count, 10 games with two wins, and the season's blown over, hasn't it? Just the wins against Dover, and that was a hard match, coming from behind twice to beat Dover 3-2. And Wealdstone, which of course was the couple of good goals from Grimes and Quigley. But when we went into the final home match of the season against Woking, there were people thinking, well, do you know what? If we don't make the playoffs, it's not the end of the world, because we ain't going to do anything anyway. And then, of course, go to Halifax and win 2-1, and it's, wow, where did that come from?
Yeah, it was an excellent performance, wasn't it? I think we benefited from, were Halifax in with a shout of automatic promotion until a few games before the end of the season?
Yeah, I think they had been, but it was,
and I think we benefited a bit from their failure to do that, in that they weren't at all in the right frame of mind to play a playoff match, it seemed to me. But you still have to be able to capitalise, don't you? Sorry?
We've still got the free hit, really.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you still have to be able to go there, play well, and beat them. Of course, there was all the talk, wasn't there, earlier in the season, of their manager coming to replace Rowe, and he decided to stay at Halifax, and then we went and knocked them out of the playoffs. So there was a certain amount of satisfaction in that, as I recall. But yeah, was there a parallel with that feeling? You know, if we don't get in the playoffs, it might spare us humiliation. You know, we can build for next year and all of that. Was there a parallel with a similar sort of feeling in League One when we got into the playoffs? You know, because we weren't ever so good in the last few games of that season, if I recall.
No. I think a win over, was it a 1-0 win over Crewe in the last minute, capitalised?
Yeah, Bristol City at home, we
lost, I think, that one. Yeah.
The critical differences between the two was in the League One playoffs. At the start of the season, we weren't expected to do anything like that.
No.
Whereas halfway through last season, we were expected to be champions. So, the feeling was different. It was we've not got the firepower of the Prestons of this world in 2015, which we clearly hadn't.
Interesting, of course, that we lost our leading scorer halfway through both seasons.
Yes.
Very much so. But we'd never really been challenging the top that season, had we? So to make the playoffs was an absolutely terrific. Yeah, there were great teams in the likes of Swindon, MK Dons and Preston, who were, those three were head and shoulders above the rest. So I think making the playoffs there was you never know what might happen. Whereas this one was, well, I know what will happen if we get to the playoffs, we'll get humiliated. But that 2-1 game against Halifax changed it all around. And when Joe Quigley made it 1-0 at Solihull Moors in the conference playoff, which of course was one step further than we'd gone the year before, let's not forget.
Absolutely.
It was all of a sudden, oh, right, here we go. But then just couldn't quite hold on.
No, I thought that Halifax game, I thought, well, that came out of nowhere. You know, that result absolutely came out of nowhere, because Halifax would have been heavy favourites going into that finishing fourth. You know, but then taking that momentum forward into the Solihull Moors game, you're thinking, all right, okay, right, we'll have a go here with Solihull Moors. You know, Cheswell beat them at there, you know, beat them at Solihull. And, you know, we unluckily lost at home, I'd say, against them. At the technique, let's have a right good go. So 8 minutes in, Quigley scores, thinking, right, game on here. This is have a go. But of course, Solihull Moors had a bit more about them, didn't they? Dallas Goodger and Howe put us to the sword somewhat.
Yeah. Halifax had been unbeaten at home in 10 when we went there and won. So you know they were on fire at the Shay, no question about that. But couldn't quite get there. And yes, those of us who are optimists would say, well, hey, we've gone one step further than last time. But Daz, it was a season that promised so much and ultimately ended in a disappointing fashion.
Oh, yeah, definitely what might have been, I think. It's progress. In literal terms, it's progress. And I think if you look where the club was, where the team and the squad were, who we got in charge. If you look back to when John Pemberton left, I mean, we were light years further forward in reality.
Yeah.
And much more geared up for a summer of change, which we knew we were going to have, and then to launch another attack under Paul Cook, which thankfully has materialised. And I know there's one or two people already saying that, you know, the title's gone. I don't think it's anywhere near gone, personally. We win our games in hand and we beat Notts and Wrexham and it's game on. In fact, not lose to Notts and Wrexham and it's game on. So I think there's an awful long way to go. There's half a season, more or less, isn't there, still to play. There'll be lots of twists and turns. I think we've had a couple of little blips. And I'm sure at some point so will they. And I think we're better equipped all round than we were. We're not reliant on Cabby in the same way or any one individual player to score the goals that we were. I think, did you say we'd had 14 or 15 different scorers this season?
Yeah, 15.
Which is a good trait to have. And he's got options off the bench. Certainly the bench is... He's so much stronger than it was 12 months ago when we were really, you know, you looked at the bench and thought, well, who the hell is he going to bring on to change this if you were in bother? But at least now we have got options all over the pitch, really, including at the back, which last year was decimated for long periods towards the end of the season. So, yeah, I think overall disappointed, obviously, from where we were just after Christmas, post Chelsea. I think we were all thinking after that second half performance at Barnet that we would be hammering out and trying to get top spot. But in reality, we fell quite a long way short, didn't we?
And my view, which I've shared with various people, including Paul Cook, I've had a conversation with him about it, Stu, is that, you know, there were people who were pointing the fingers at, including pundits on TV, at Paul Cook saying, oh, look at that, you know, he's blown a winning position and only just made the playoffs by the skin of his teeth, blah, blah, blah. But I think, for me, the biggest issue, losing Cabby was a big issue, but I think the biggest issue was Paul Cook is a manager who trusts his players and asks them to go out and express themselves within a particular style, whereas his predecessor was if you're standing on the wrong blade of grass at any time, you'll never play for us again. I think all of a sudden it's a situation where the players couldn't make that transition quickly enough. They've had the summer and they've made the transition, but they didn't have when you're playing Saturday, Tuesday, and you can't really spend a lot of time. And people, and you know, James Rowe was really good at getting people to know what their jobs were. I'm not saying that's a criticism. It's just an approach to how you do it. But Paul Cook's approach is very different. Yes. And the players, you know, in my opinion, Stuart, the players couldn't quite get their head around quick enough.
No, you're absolutely right with that. It is not a question of the players not having the necessary technical skills and all of that to play Paul Cook-style football. But as you say, the change from one manner of being managed to another, as well as a change in style, all came too quickly and at exactly the wrong time of the year. Absolutely. And the fact that we've been able to change the staff a bit and bring people in and change the style and, you know, be where we are in the league, indicates that the right move was made in bringing Cookie in. Does to me anyway.
Well, so ultimate disappointment at the end of 21-22. And so a busy summer and straight into football in 22-23. And we'll be talking about that momentarily. So after the disappointment of dropping out of the playoffs for the second season on the trot, Paul Cook started his training regime the way he wanted to do, started working with players, had several weeks to work with them on the training pitch, started bringing in his own players, the players that he wanted to bring in. A couple of underwhelming transfers to start off with, young Joe Cook and Bailey Clements. But then all of a sudden, one or two of the bigger hitters started coming in, Banks, George Cooper, Mike Jones, you know, that started bringing a little bit of experience in as well. But all still at a time where they got a lot to offer in their career. And one of the very first things, Paul, that we started witnessing was that some of the inherited players under Paul Cook were thriving. And I'm just thinking Quigley, Mandeville, King and Grimes, who you know, stepped up to the plate and the next plate above it.
Yeah, regular. Must have given some confidence as well to fit into a system. you know, we know Jeff King is what he is, you know, but he's attacking, and that's what Paul Cook likes. You know, the defensive side of things, he kind of forgives him a little bit for it, doesn't he? Because he gets goals and assists. Mandeville just needed either a kick up the backside or a bit more confidence. I don't know, but he certainly does fit into. He was playing regularly under James Rowe, granted, but he seems to thrive in the three behind, doesn't he? That's his sort of area, and I know he's drifted more onto the sort of right than in the middle, and that he was playing for Doncaster, but he likes to keep all the possession, and possession-based football is what Paul Cook likes. Jamie Grimes is the big surprise for me. You know, he was on his way out, wasn't he, after the Maidenhead game, as we touched on. But his confidence levels have gone up and gone up. And remember, he's 32 years old now. He's been rewarded with a new contract, you know. So once he gains trust in players, I think it is. I think it's trust. It must be. Then he works with them. And they'll give their all for it. And the thing is, which I think is quite noble from either the player and the manager receiving that trust from the player as well. He seems to be a good man manager. You know, don't fall out with him, granted. But if you do, work hard to try and gain his trust again.
Yeah. And he does allow you to do that, doesn't he? He does allow you to get back in. But, Daryl, you know, when we were talking about Quigley there, but of the players that went out of the door, the biggest surprise, the one that raised the most eyebrows, was Alex Whittle, because he'd had a terrific season the year before, unlucky not to be player of the year, but very, very unlucky. And at the moment, the left backs are one of the positions that the manager's not quite sure about which his best player is, whether it's Clements or Horton. Horton started off with a shirt, and when Clements has come in, he's done really, really well. But last Saturday, Horton played again. So, or last match, it was Boxing Day, wasn't it? So, has Whittle been forgotten?
Oh, in all fairness to Alex, I think both of them are better than him. So it's a different argument we're having now, isn't it? It's horses for courses. Personally, I think Clements is the better footballer and he's better defensively. And if you're asking me tomorrow who plays at Wrexham, it's Clements. But if you wanted to attack teams at home or against a weaker opposition like we had away on Boxing Day, it's probably Horton. So, yeah, sadly, as good as Alex Whittle did for us, I think we've improved.
And Stuart, the likes of Armando Dobra, I know he was out for a while with an injury. Armando Dobra and the return of Ollie Banks and the introduction of Darren Oldacre, all of a sudden, you know, the recruitment that Paul Cook put in the summer it started immediately to bear fruit.
Absolutely, immediately, didn't it? And all, you know, and all five players in that midfield, including two who were here previously, all clicked at the same time, all seemed to develop an understanding almost overnight, you know. They're all talented individuals, and I think they all respect each other's ability. And they just get on so well as a team group. Dobra on the left is that sort of unknown quantity, isn't he, that will attract as many critics over his time in football as he does attract people who praise him, I'm sure. But, you know, he has that certain golden quality, that sort of sprinkle of stardust in his play, doesn't he, that, you know, you don't see very often even in a division or two higher than this one. So we're lucky to have him here, I think. And Ollie Banks and DJ Oldacre, just the glue, or just at the start of the season anyway, were the glue that sort of held all that together, weren't they? That gave you that kind of almost impenetrable platform to win the ball back a long way up the pitch should anybody among the forwards or the attacking midfielders have lost it. Kept the pressure on, kept the press nice and high. And you can't keep that going all season, perhaps. So you do need to change things around, which is where Mike Jones has come in, and a slight change in formation that people thought Cookie would never do, would never forsake his beloved formation and change it slightly. Well, he has brought in Jonesy. And it meant that we're playing as effectively now as we were at the start of the season, albeit differently.
Well, is Mike Jones the current Paul Cook incarnation of Richie Humphreys?
Well,
Well, in terms of an experienced man having an influence,
experienced in the dressing room rather than positional. Yeah.
I'm still scarred by poor old Richie Humphreys coming on as a sub against Sheffield United, and then his first touch was to roll the ball at their player who went on and scored.
Team that Richie Humphreys was brought up supporting.
And that, you know, one of two games at that point where I actually got up and left before the final whistle, I'd seen enough, you know. So I'm still scarred by that memory. But Richie Humphreys was a good man, and a good man to have around the changing room, certainly. And in that respect, Mike Jones has that character and that experience, and can be a great benefit to people who are still trying to make their way in the game.
And of course, Paul, Lucas Coverland coming in on season's loan from Port Vale. Red card first match. Ross Fitzsimons dragged from the Rock of Gibraltar to come in. And I know Coverland came back in for a wee while, but hey, Fitzsimons has done pretty well, hasn't he?
No, he's done really well, hasn't he? You know, was it four games he played in the Europa Conference League before Chesterfield even started, considering their season? Well, he struck lucky, hasn't he? You know, in many respects, because Coughlin getting injured meant he got a regular start in the game. Obviously, he got the three games that Coughlin was out for. But Paul Cook brought Coughlin in because he plays from the back, doesn't he? And he wants to bring the defenders forward and create areas in midfield for space. But he's also got that electric spark about him that can get him sent off, as we found out on the day. And as predicted by Mark White, the manager of Dorking, this bloke's, how did you describe him? Erratic, or he's got a temper or something like that, doesn't he?
Yeah, he inferred he's got a red card in him, didn't he?
Yeah, and he was proved absolutely correct. So,
great start to the season, 7-3-0 in terms, and picking out one or two of the games. Obviously, Dorking 2-0 up, and then the sending off was that. But the 2-0 home victory over Wrexham, then 2-0 up at Notts before a familiar conceding a couple quick on. And then the 3-2 10-man win over Southend were, for me, the ones to really talk about in that. We'll take one of you each. So you, Paul, start off with that 2-0 Wrexham.
Yeah, that was a stunning performance. Really, it's what hadn't happened in the first half in the previous fixture at home, as Daryl alluded to previously, is that the team blooming scored, didn't they, when they had the opportunities to. I mean, the first goal was Jeff King being allowed to dance into the box, wasn't it, onto his wrong boot and score past Mark Howard. But the second one was a mistake from Mark Howard, and Banksy scored a fine finish, didn't he, from 20 yards out. And they didn't know what hit them at all, did they, Wrexham? It was like wave after wave of opportunities. They couldn't get out of their own half. And so much so that Chesterfield pushed Mullin and Palmer back to defending throughout the game until, I'd say about 80 minutes or something, that they had a snapshot from Mullin which went wide.
It was 89.
I mean, incredible. And
the irony was, I remember saying on commentary at the end that the best player for Wrexham, without any shadow of doubt, was Paul Mullin, but that was in his own half defending.
Exactly.
It was a performance.
It was. There were pockets of Wrexham where you think, oh, they're a really good team. There were areas about them in midfield when they had the ball, they were pinging it left, right and centre. You think, oh, they're quite good, these. Which was totally against what Phil Parkinson likes to do. You know, normally it's just look up into the skies, isn't it, and everything. That said to me that this side mean absolute business. And to take that confidence into the Notts County game as well, again, 2-0 up, you know. But if it wasn't for Horton's knee creating an opportunity for Langstaff, Chesterfield could have got away with the 3 points in that game as well.
That first hour, Stuart, great performance at Meadow Lane. Mandeville and Asante putting Chesterfield two up, like you say. It was the Grimes and Horton, weren't there, that combined on the edge of the box at the wrong end. I watched it time and again, and it hit Horton's knee, but he was just trying to get to the ball. He was unlucky. I suppose, Stuart, when you've got somebody who subsequently has proved how deadly they are in Langstaff, who not had a kick, suddenly gets two goals in 3 minutes.
Yeah, they made a substitution, just a minute, a double substitution, didn't they, just a minute or two before.
Yeah the deadly Cairo Mitchell has come on. Mitchell and Jim O'Brien had come on.
Was it Sam Austin, the winger, who'd come on, I think?
Austin came on,
Kedwin Scott and Austin came on for Mitchell and O'Brien. I got it the wrong way around.
And I think that we must have been wondering what to do about that while they went and scored both those goals, you know. But it all settled down again after that quickly enough, I thought. And really, you look at it and you think, oh, that's a game that we might have won if we'd have just been able to avoid a silly minute. But you can't, you can't go through the whole season dogging yourself with that, I don't think. And a positive result for us, a team that wants to finish above us in the league didn't beat us at home. That's got to be a positive for me,
And as all of a sudden, Cabby's back in the fray. Clearly not looking absolutely 100% compared to where he was before. And, you know, coming off the bench, coming in and out of the side a little bit. But as every week went by, Quigley looking more and more worth his place.
Yeah, it's been a funny one, hasn't it, really? Because for me, he doesn't score enough goals. And I think that's one of the areas where, if we talk later about where would you strengthen, I think we need more support up top, because I'm not convinced that we've got enough right at the top end of the pitch. Cabby, I still think 90% of it's between his ears, in all honesty. The psychological damage of an injury like that, until you get a really good whack and get up again, I think, you know, you worry about whether you'll ever be the same again. I think all the hoo-ha around the transfer, non-transfer to Birmingham didn't help, because they obviously planted in his mind that they'd found something medically wrong with him. And I think we've subsequently put that to bed on more than one occasion with other medical opinions who've said absolute nonsense. But this plays on a player's mind, and he must have been gutted to have missed out the opportunity to leap, bear in mind the number of divisions he was going to leap, to go from non-league to the Championship, let's not forget. Mm. And so I suspect 90% of the issue with Cabby is between his ears. The other thing is, when he comes on, or when he's had the odd start, I don't think we play to his strengths. I don't think we slip balls down the side of the centre backs and between people into his feet. And when we do, he'll get the penalty like he did a couple of weeks ago, or score if we turn quickly like Dobra did in the Barnet game and slip him in first time behind the back four. So yeah, it's a combination of things. He hasn't turned into a bad player overnight, and he's still got a striker's instinct, but I don't think we're playing to his strengths when he's on the pitch, is all I would say.
Anyway, Kevin wasn't involved at all against Southend, on the bench or anywhere, but by this time, the likes of Ukeg Boolam and Akinola had joined the squad. Mm. Decent start for Chesterfield against Southend. Jack Clark scored, but Southend equalised. Then, just as half time approaching, Ollie Banks sent off. It proved to be harsh because it was rescinded. But straight after the break, Stu, Southend 2-1 in the lead, and Chesterfield really, really up against it. And at that point, you know, it was Akinola initially coming off the bench that helped to turn that game, with Quigley and King scoring 62-68. And the Sparrows putting in an absolutely phenomenal second half performance.
It was, wasn't it? That absolutely tore Southend to pieces. For those who, unfortunately, we haven't got vision. My cat has just jumped up and is waving itself in my face. So everybody's laughing at that, and that's making me laugh. Yeah, Southend, a tremendous second half. You know, the crowd all got behind the team, and the, you know, the place was rocking again. And we got the equaliser, didn't we, reasonably quickly, and just kept on pressing and pressing and pressing until they finally cracked, and we got the very late winner. Oh, no, it wasn't a late winner, was it? It was King on 69. Yeah. But yeah, we you know, we just really turned it all around to our own advantage in the end. You know, there was a feeling of wrongness over the sending off that we, you know, rather than feel sorry for ourselves, we turned to our own advantage, really. And all that gave us the strength to come powering back like we did. Great performance that, of course, kept us top of the league at the time.
And that, you were talking about, it wasn't late against Southend, but it was a late show for the next few games in one way or another. Jeff Ukeg Boolam scored late on to equalise at Yeovil. Then the
88th minute, his equaliser, which was the earliest of the next four late goals. The other three were...
Yes, that's right. Maidstone equalised on 88. The match after before, Oldacre scored on 90. Then Maidenhead, even though Maidenhead were 2-0 up, Tyrone Williams started his 90th minute routine there. He scored to pull one back against Maidenhead before pulling one back against Dagenham and Redbridge in the 3-2 defeat the week after. Then Eastley scored in the last minute to beat us 2-1 to end that mad week. Maidenhead, Dagenham, Redbridge and Eastley. And how important that week was, Paul, is we're still talking about that mad week.
Yeah, we're still talking about it and playing catch up on the back of that. How much those 9 points would be grateful for this that football club right now, wouldn't they? Just add them on and it would be right up there. So it's incredible, really, isn't it? An incredible spell of 90 minute goals, and you just think, oh, I'm going to get out of this. They need a competition that is not the National League to play. You want to play a lower league side in your next game, and they thankfully got that away at Anstey. So they needed something to kind of reboost their season. They didn't need a National League game, and they didn't get that.
Yeah, and then five wins and a draw in the next six National League matches, and all of a sudden back on the bike, Daz.
Yeah, we have bounced back remarkably well. I've no idea, thinking about it, where that bloody week came from, because there were no signs of it, were they? In all honesty,
well, Maidenhead United.
Sign, to be fair.
Yeah. we hadn't. I don't think we played particularly well at Yeovil, had we? And probably were a little bit fortunate to come away with a point. But it was totally out of the blue, and it was almost as if teams had sussed it out. Every goal we conceded seemed to be down that left channel between Horton and Grimes in those three games. It was madness. And we needed the reset. And thank God, not something we're used to saying as Spirites, but thank God the FA Cup gave us a reset. And we've since gone on a really, really solid run, haven't we? I mean, the Halifax game, which, again, I don't know where that performance came from, in all honesty, because we started off there okay for the first 10-15 minutes, didn't we? Looked as though we were going to miss a couple of early chances, and thought, well, we're gonna get something out of the game, but in the end lost quite comfortably, but then bounced back again. So whatever it was in the water for those three games, I hope they don't put it in the water again, because it was so out of character for this team just to produce three performances as poor as those.
And you're dovetailing nicely there, Daz, with the FA Cup, Stuart. It's tough to get to the third round any year for Chesterfield, but they're starting the qualifiers, so to battle through qualifier four, round one and round two, three successful rounds, these things just don't happen, do they?
Well, no, except they've happened
twice on the
bounce now, haven't they? No, it doesn't happen to us, does it, that we win one, two, three games in succession in the Cup in successive years. It's, this season we've so far won them to love, haven't we? You know, we've not conceded a goal in it yet.
Dobra scored in every game as well.
Yeah.
Lots of great statty things on the FA Cup this season.
Yeah, and both the Northampton and the Wimbledon games were won in some degree of comfort, I thought. These are teams that are in a division above us, and what, Wimbledon had not lost for 13 matches or something, hadn't they? And yet we go there and it just seems a fairly straightforward, we'll go and do this and we'll beat them, and we did it,
Looking, Stuart, forward to the West Brom game early in the new year. It's only the third time in Chesterfield's history that they'll be welcoming to their own ground a team that's won the FA Cup five or more times at the time of the game. Yeah. Blackburn Rovers back in the early 60s and Aston Villa in the 30s are the only time that Chesterfield have welcomed a five or more times Cup winner. I think Villa and Blackburn had both won it six times at the time they visited. Of course, we've played Arsenal at home in the Cup, but I don't think they ever won the FA Cup when we played them. They're a recent team to win it. So, to me, it's a fantastic draw, not playing West Brom for 48 years. And, of course, they're four divisions higher than us. So if Chesterfield do beat West Brom, Stuart, it'll be statistically the biggest giant killing we've ever had.
Yeah, yeah. you look back to the
positions between the two teams.
You
Midland League beating Everton is a big one in 1918 or 17 or 14 or whenever it was. But of course, the Midland League was technically immediately below the Football League at that time, wasn't it?
It was, but it was some way below the Football League, and that's what makes it slightly difficult. You know, the Southern League was more powerful than the Midland League, so. Yeah. You know, but the Midland League was a direct route into the Football League for teams in the Midlands and the North. Yeah, beat Chelsea. No, we beat Bolton, didn't we, in 1912, I think. But yeah, that bigger gap has just not been there. It would be quite an achievement. Unfortunately, since the draw was made, West Brom have started winning matches, haven't they? Which
New gaffer's got a 78-point something win rate. Yeah.
Well, hopefully now he'll be so confident of their ability to succeed that he'll think, "Oh, I'll rest the first team for this one and just put the reserves out." But I can't see that personally with a Championship team. If it was a Premiership team again, they might do, but. No, it'll be a good game. I'm looking forward to it.
The irony was when the draw was made, you think, oh, West Brom will be more interested in staying up. They'll play the reserves. Yeah. Now you look at the table, it's a West Brom will be more interested in getting into the playoffs.
Yeah.
They'll play the reserves.
Yeah. Yeah. which shows how quickly everything can change. And I suppose spins right back to Darryl's point. I'm not sure whether we were on here or not when he expressed it, that, you know, the season in terms of 1, 2, and 3 in the National League is not over by any means yet, you know. It can change.
No question about that. And yeah, we're unlucky that we're just in a division this time that's got two exceptional teams who
Stockport won it last season. Lost 10 games on the way to doing it's entirely conceivable that the top three teams in the National League this season won't lose 10 between them, all carry on as they are doing.
Hopefully they will, but hopefully we'll lose no more than 4.
That would be nice. That would be preferable outcome, but you know, it's always a bit of a gamble, I suppose, isn't it, when you invest in team, you know, in players and off-field teams and stuff like that to try and get promotion. And we might finish third and judge that any effort we've made was wasted, but we might well finish third, but we're likely to finish third with a record that would have got us promoted as champions on, you know, 19 out of the last 20 seasons in the National League. It's just absolutely crackers that Wrexham have come along and finally spent enough money to buy their way out of it, and not sort of benefited as I thought they would do by the departure of their previous manager. He was a decent chap, decent manager, but tended to overthink things, I think. And they've, you know, pulled out a plum with their recruitment, haven't they?
A small squad and one that's focused on winning. You know, he's working with a core group of players, and they seem to be playing well for them. Despite the fact, early on in the season, I didn't think they were up for it, Notts County. I didn't think. I felt Wrexham were the better team out of the two showings that we'd had. But that said, you know, things change, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And you know, the Rodriguez is hardly getting any notifications this season because, of course, the two ex-Gateshead lads, Scott and Langstaff, are getting all the notice. But Rodriguez has got 8 goals. The defender, Chickson, has got 7. There's a lad on loan that they've picked up since they played us, De Castro, who's on loan from West Brom, ironically, who's been coming off the bench quite a bit, but he's had 4 starts, 8 subs, and scored 4 goals. So he's obviously added a little bit of something to the to the thing as well. You look at Joel Taylor, you know, a player who we were disappointed to lose when he went. He started 2 games this season.
He's gone out
on loan somewhere, hasn't he? Yeah. Richard Brindley's still a regular, the former Sparite. They signed John Bostock. His record so far is 3 sub appearances, no starts. And that was, you know, the Notts County fans were saying, oh, what a great signing that is. Well, he's not gone into the team yet. I don't know if that's because he's not showing what's needed, or is showing what's needed and it's not enough. who knows? But they've got plenty in there, and they have got a lot of players who are playing a lot of games. You know, they're not changing. Brindley's played 20, started 21, Cameron's 24, Chickson 24, Langstaff 23, Palmer 22, Rodriguez 23, Slocum 24. Hey, the core of the team doesn't change. You
know? Yeah. So that's their gamble, I suppose, isn't it? That they're relying on nobody getting a tackle from behind at Weymouth and being, you know, out with a broken leg for the rest of the season.
We know what that does to us, doesn't it? Let's just briefly look back at Boxing Day, Scunthorpe United. I think over the years, Paul, we can look at this, and it's not a question of getting into statistical minutiae. The days of home advantage have slipped an awful long way. When I first started going, even in a decent season, if you won 5 away games, you'd had a great season. But now the difference between home, because the pitches are better, the tactical awareness are better, is a much closer home and away thing than there used to be. But I still can't get my head around thinking any away win's a good away win. But that last 20 minutes at Scunthorpe was anything but good, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was starting to get really, really nervy, wasn't it? I mean, it was real sort of harem scarem stuff, wasn't it? That they had that big one chance that they got, but it was the pressure from that Chesswell just couldn't seem to keep hold of the ball for some strange reason, just kept giving it away. It was ridiculous. They brought on Ukegbulam, didn't they, to try and push the ball further forward and keep hold of it and stay up front and whatnot, but nobody passed to him. So there was that scenario there. But yeah, my word, they had to work hard for that 3 points, let's just say, but which is complete contrast to the first half an hour when I thought Chester were going to get five at one stage. And then they scored against a run of play. What's alarming, though, that I found is the number of goals where Chester would have conceded with a ball straight through the middle. And this one was a little flick over the top, granted, and it felt kindly for Levery. But again, it's through the middle rather than an attack from the wings. That's my concern. But yeah, we go into this sort of anomaly again that's saying, well, 3 points in 3 points, let's rub his hands, and a huge sigh of relief. Let's come away with it and move on to the next game and hopefully turn up for 90 minutes.
Yeah, and of course, Scunny, who I think they're on a transfer embargo, there's a potential that they might lose a couple of loan players. Lavery's only signed up to the end of the month, isn't he, I think?
End of the month, yeah.
Lapto went off injured. I mean, the goalkeeper went off injured, but I think Dewhurst had been suffering with a bit of crisis of confidence a little bit. But Owen Foster did really well. He's only 17-year-old and injured his shoulder. I'm sure he'll not be back. But you've got to think, Daz, really, that we'll have enough in the tank to put it right. Well, we've not got much to put right because we still won, but to win with a little bit more comfort at the technique.
I don't see the panic that you lads see. I was at the game and I never felt in any bother at all when we went 2-1. I mean, the only problem was...
27 years.
I didn't think we were in any
bother. We've had it before, last-minute winners.
The only thing that worried me was, after the Cook incident, when he got sent off, or actually, in the lead-up to him being sent off, the referee, who I thought had been excellent up to then, suddenly gave three of the daftest decisions known to man to them, which obviously incensed Cookie, led to his sending off. And after that, we never got a thing off him. And that's why they were able to apply pressure, because every time we challenged for the ball, they got a free kick and could launch it into the box. But generally speaking, I thought we dealt with it really well. Whether Fitzsimmons was coming and catching and punching, or whether Palmer, who loves to attack headers, which I love in both boxes, incidentally, we just got rid of it. The one where Lavery shot and hit his own man on the line, we got the goalkeeper and another player behind him anyway. I think you lads are overly panicking in the press box. I really do. getting back to New Year's Day, we should have enough to beat them. And I think like with any side, we know when we've been down at the bottom and you're on this spiral that they've been on for the last few seasons. If we get a couple of goals early doors, it could be how many up. Well, ever you give them something to cling on to, and that was the problem on Monday, wasn't it? That they, having had complete control, hit the woodwork twice and looked like scoring every time we went down the pitch, they got one out of nothing, and it gave them something to hang on to. And if they'd have held on to it for another 10 minutes, it might have been really difficult. But as it was, we got the equaliser, what, within 5 minutes, was it, something like that? And then just went on second half and really put it to bed, I thought, really professionally, to be honest. So, provided we get a decent score, get our noses in front,
all I can say, Daz, you were sardining with 1,540 yeah. And you couldn't see properly because we were down the other end and it were nail-biting.
You must have been there when Ian Barraclough whipped in a 90th minute winner, and Billy Sharp and Gary Hooper, and I can name Andy Keogh. They've all scored blooming last minute winners against us, or chuffing last minute equalisers against us.
I've been there for in the all past, votes, but thankfully none of the above were playing, and that's why Scunny are in the position they're in.
That is a good point. Yeah.
I've been down the club today. I was showing a couple of guys who were over from Illinois, showing them around the ground, having a chat. And I did ask what Cookie's touchline ban would be, because of course it's his second indiscretion of the season. Four yellow cards meant one, so I don't know if it'd be a too much touchline ban. And nobody that I came across actually knew. I didn't see the football secretary, so I wasn't too sure. But I was delighted to hear that, because like when a player's sent off, they're not allowed to be in a position where they can see the match. It's the same with the manager. Yeah. So Paul Cook had to go where he couldn't see the match. And somebody told me today he managed to tune into 1866 Sport and listen to the last 20 minutes on the radio for his to keep
so,
it.
So he was panicking as well then, was he?
Yeah. He will have been. If you were listening to me and Josh, he will have definitely been panicking. No question about that. So I'm not quite sure what touchline ban he'll get. But of course, he'll be in vision of the pitch. It's not, you're not banned from the ground. I think Mourinho got banned from the ground, didn't he, when he was at Chelsea some time ago. But a touchline ban, you've got to be within, at least a minimum, and there's a specific 10 yards or whatever it is from the touchline. But
he'll have to stick his hand in his pocket and buy a screening of it, won't he?
Yeah, you're not actually allowed to sit in the director's box, though, I don't think. But when there's no box as such, there's no line drawn, what is the director's box in this day and age?
Wasn't there that rumour that Mourinho went in the kit...
In the wicker skip
into the dressing room and came out of that, did his team talk, went back in it and was pushed out like out.
I think too many people have been watching Escape from Stalag 16 or something.
Yeah. Yeah, Cookie might be in the barrel watching it on the stream in the back.
what sort of barrel?
Don't forget to sync it up with 1866 Sport commentary, Paul. In terms of, I know it's a review of 2022, Ron, looking forward to 2023, but we can't not look forward to 2023. If you look at the club, the squad, the manager, on the 1st of January 2023, and compare it to the squad, the manager, and the club on the 1st of January 2022. What's the comparison, Daz? You had the biggest ooh on the pictures, I thought, there. So I thought we'll start with you then, because you look the least prepared to answer that.
I think the squad is 25% better, if not more. I worry that we're carrying a lot of players that aren't anywhere near the first team. And they all cost money. And I suspect the budgets are under a lot of strain. Thank God for a cup run again. I also reckon Cabby will go one way or another in January. Wouldn't surprise me at all. In fact, I'd be more surprised if he stayed. So I do think we're going to need to bring somebody in up front. But if you look at Asante's not playing very much, Maguire, Whelan's in and out, Clark's hardly played, Olieke's due to be coming back to fitness, Shackleford hasn't played, but he's obviously replacement right back. Danny Rowe, what's happening with him? Joe Cook's down at Dorking. Is it for the rest of the season? I can't remember. Gyasi's out on loan somewhere, isn't he? Where's he gone?
Gloucester.
Yeah. So just those alone, if you look at the number of bodies we've got, we've got at least two players for every position, with the possible exception of up front, where I think we're thin.
We've got two on loan.
Yeah. But my indication is if they're on loan, they're on loan for a reason. I agree with trying to keep them match fit and all this kind of stuff. But had they shown enough, I think they would have been kept in and around the squad. Rather than go out on loan. And it is a difficulty at our level when you haven't got anywhere for them to play behind closed doors or reserve games or whatever. It is a problem trying to keep players fit and or get players fit again after injury. But as a squad, as I say, I think we're at least 25%, if not better, than we were 12 months ago. I'll take Paul Cook over James Rowe any day of the week. you know, both in terms of his personality, but his nous and his track record and everything else. Let's face it, Rowe's done nothing, had he? You know, he'd had a successful 8 games at Gloucester City or whatever it was, came to us, hit the ground running in a COVID season. Who knows how much that affected things. It was all a bit turmoil while he was here, wasn't it? Nothing was very straightforward. I mean, the transfer thing was like a revolving door. At least we've got a bit of stability back in the place. I do think we need to unload some bodies, and would like a couple in, particularly up front. But other than that, I think we're in a really decent place.
Is Daryl talking sense or stupidity, Stu?
Sense.
Oh, good grief.
I should have tried to sound less surprised. No, it absolutely sense there. I mean, you know, the squad is better now than it was a year ago, I think. You know, I think Paul said earlier, look at what we have on the bench now compared to what we had on the bench then, when we were bringing on, you know, decent triers, people with the right kind of attitude, like Jack McCourt and Jim Kellerman, but now we've got people with the right attitude and more ability on the bench. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. As Daryl says, I think Paul Cook is, you know, for all his kind of ranting and getting sent up to the stands on a regular basis, is calmer in the day-to-day running and the sort of slightly longer-term projection of the team. I'm not entirely sure that the previous manager looked more than one game in advance ever, you know, and if you had a bad game, you were out, you know, as we saw, you know, especially with Grimes in that Maidenhead game is the perfect example. So I think Cook's a bit better at having a plan and keeping to it. And I think that benefits everybody. Whether we're better off, I mean, ironically, of course, we're one place lower, you know, or two places lower than we were this time last year. So I suppose you can say, what has that got us? But we're only lower than we were last year because the two teams above us are having an exceptional seasons. But I think we are in a better place, certainly. Yeah, much better.
And Paul, I don't know if you realised it, Paul Cook actually is the manager. You know, you don't talk to him all that often, do you, really? But,
no idea.
Paul who?
I have no idea. Paul who?
Paul who? Yeah. But in terms of, you know, the feel of the recruitment, yeah, revolving doors was the phrase that Stuart used. But he's back onto that young and hungry, isn't he? And yeah. Whilst Mike Jones is the token experienced man, and yeah, Ollie Banks has just turned 30, hasn't he? The likes of Oldacre, who nearly jacked in the game when he was at Gillingham a few years ago, and Ukeg Boolam and Akinola, you know, the young and hungry is very much back on the agenda, isn't it?
Yeah, he's not using the term, and I quote, waste of space as attributing into young players that the previous manager was. So he's brought in players that are actually got something going for them and ability to learn as well, you know. So the previous manager brought in seasoned players for that level. And it worked, didn't it? It worked. Who's to say what Chesterfield wouldn't have done going forward? There might have been a shining light moment where, you know, James Rowe stayed towards the end of the season. Only his sort of discretion got him out of the job. But you look at it last season, Chesterfield was 6 points worse off, but top of the table, this exact stage of the season. So he wouldn't swap this season for any other season. It's quite remarkable that despite being better than last season, they're the third best team in the National League. It's complete folly, isn't it, really? It just doesn't happen.
We should also consider, I think, that at the end of this season, we are going to be far stronger than we were at the end of last season.
Yeah.
And that's when we need the team to be stronger, isn't it?
Yeah.
No, yeah, if you don't finish in that top spot, you want to be strong, don't you? And you know, whilst we scraped into the playoffs last season, you don't see that as being the case this time. You know, whilst give Woking great credit, really having a great season, and Jim Kellerman's playing really well for them by all accounts, you can't really see not being in that top three, Paul.
No, I can't. I can see just for finishing second. You know, in that, even sort of creating a few worries for the number one spot, but that's a wild prediction, isn't it? But I can't. Chesterfield are one of the top three sides in the table. You know, it's how they go against other sides that it sounds confusing, but it's how they go and approach games against other sides they're expected to beat, other than Notts County and Wrexham. That is the difference between the three teams.
And you were saying, Daryl, because we've not managed to get rid of some of the players who Paul Cook's been looking to move on to free up pound notes, the cup runs helped a little bit. So have the crowds. You know, pat on the back for the Chesterfield support. They're going to be, you know, well over 7,000 against Scunthorpe United, and there's going to be 9,000 against West Brom, you'd have thought. And I know that's a divvy up on the on the games against the two teams and the FA and everything. But, you know, they'll help no end going into next season, of which one or two of the also-rans will be able to be offloaded. That said, the daft thing is, and I know... there's a lot of people at the club think this, somebody like Lawrence Maguire would be a lot better in League Two than he will be in the National League because of the different level of physicality in the game.
Yeah, potentially so. I mean, Miller was one of the transfer listed guys. Asante Maguire, who was the other one with the four altogether?
Gunning.
Yeah. So we've managed by hook or by crook to get rid of a couple of them, haven't we?
Asante was taken off the list relatively early on as well, wasn't he?
So. So really, Lawrence will be one of the ones, but Danny Rowe's obviously on a few bob, and we've been getting some kind of subsidy towards that while he's been at Fylde. But will he stay at Fylde? I mean, they've had obviously the James Rowe thing as well, and the change of manager and all that. Does he see his long term future there? Do they want him?
I think he's injured at the minute.
Is he? Yeah.
He's not played the last three games.
I mean, will we want to?
But his relationship was with Fylde rather than.
Yeah,
with
Ryan, I think he's. It, I so. Think he's with the owner rather than anybody else there, isn't it? So there's lots of questions to be asked in the next few weeks. Bearing in mind, if any of our players do have aspirations to get into the Football League or above, they've got a month to do it in. If you're happy to go to another National League team or below, then you've got till March, haven't you? But I do think there needs to be movement out and in the next few weeks.
Yeah, and like you say, that's quite rightly, the National League doesn't have the window as such. But if you do want to go into the league, you've got now. If another National League team wanted Lawrence Maguire and Lawrence Maguire wanted to go to another National League team, it would have happened by
yes.
now.
Yeah.
So his the reality with him is if he does go out the door, it'll be almost certainly to a league team, unless another National League team loses a left-sided central defender to a long-term injury in the next couple of weeks.
Which
then makes it a slightly different set of circumstances, doesn't it? But because I think he has, I think there have been suitors, other clubs, but for whatever reason, not right for him. But yeah, we can't expect, I don't think, another set of crowd, because I mean this will be the best average crowds, all being well, Stuart, since we moved to the new stadium, I would have thought, won't it, the season, even perhaps beating the Paul Cook promotion crowds, are they can't be far off.
I'd have to look at the relevant seasons, but they do have that feel, don't they? They certainly have that feel about them.
It's absolutely amazing, the crowd. And you've got to think, if Chesterfield don't go up this year, it's going to be difficult to sustain that next year. But if the two clubs that go up are Notts County and Wrexham, you've got to think, well, looking at the bottom of League Two and the likes of Rochdale, you think, well, you know, they've got ownership issues at the moment, which whoever thought that, because they were very stable a year or two ago. You know, there's none of the teams at the bottom of the division really put the frighteners on you for next season. Yeah. I want to go up this season. But if we don't go up this season, you'd expect it'll be Notts County and Wrexham. I know only one of those can definitely go up.
Yeah.
But, over a two-leg match, I think Chesterfield, Notts County and Wrexham are better than any of the teams in the likely to be in the playoff zone over two legs. Then you get to a one-off match and anything can happen, of course. So what do you predict the final outcome of the season to be? And who, if you had to vote for a player of the year today, would you vote for? So, final outcome, Paul?
Final outcome, I'm ever the optimist, so I think Chesterfield will finish top. And I said that all along. Not comfortably, obviously, but I always want them to win every single game, and they should have that mentality to win every single game. I know I'm not stupid, it won't happen, but I'd like Chesterfield to win the league. Thank you very much. And the player of the year, I think, has been Sir Geoff King. I think he's been superb. Assists, goals, he's not at the greatest of what months, I'd say, but still, that puts him in a very good category as one of Chesterfield's greatest ever right backs.
Well, you mentioned your 27 years since victory at Scunthorpe in the league, and the last time that makes it 1995, which was the season Chesterfield were promoted by winning in the playoffs. So my thoughts are, I think they'll go up by winning the playoffs. So because, you know, win at Scunthorpe, win at Oldham, you go down. Well, we're not going down this season, having won at Oldham, so that will be replaced by win at Scunthorpe and you go up via the playoffs. And I can't look too far away from Geoff King either. If it was just for this part of the season, of the 22-23 season, I think I'd vote for Joe Quigley. If it's for 2022 as a whole, I'd vote for Geoff King. There you go. Daz?
I think we'll finish first or second. And I think it'll go right down to the last game. And I suspect, beyond all expectations of most people, that it'll be Notts County that actually drop away. And it'll be us and Wrexham going right to the wire. And then, of course, we'll trounce Notts in the playoff final, wherever it is. If we have to finish out. Wembley, is it? Back at Wembley. Terms of player of the season so far, I'd have to say exceeded expectations, really, for me, has been Oldacre. I think he's a hell of a footballer. I preferred him further forward than when he first came and was playing the deep line role alongside Banksy. I think now Jones is in there and he's released more to go forward. he's a very, very good footballer at this level. So for him, a bit left field, but I'd say so far, up to the end of the year, from August, I would give it him by a nose at the minute.
Oh, well, I don't think he's left field at all. We've had some really good performances from a lot of players. Stuart?
We will get to Wembley, and I don't share quite Daz's optimism that it's going to go right down to the wire. I think a few weeks beforehand it'll be evident that it'll be the playoffs, but I think that'll work in our favour because we'll be able to spend more time preparing for that in that respect. But I think, yes, we'll get to Wembley, and depending upon who we face, I wouldn't be surprised if the team that finishes second, especially if they've been leading the league immediately beforehand, if they don't lose their first playoff game. So it,
well, that Wrexham did last year, yeah, of course.
Well, indeed, might end up happening to them again, mightn't it? Who knows? and, you know, I think we'll be best placed to go and win at Wembley, if you know, having got there. Because, you know, we will have been the team that has always looked like being the strongest of the playoff contenders, if you see what I mean. Player of the calendar year 2022, yeah, Kingy, I think. Yeah, Mike Jones has come in and done well, but hasn't really had a long enough run at it yet. And as Daz says, Oldacre has shown the sort of form that made him a bit of a boy wonder at Gillingham, hasn't he? Which is good. And Banksy came back and did ever so well when he dropped in there, but he's just kind of lost contact with the first team with injury recently, hasn't he? So King, yeah,
The last question I'll be asking you, which I'll not ask straight away. We'll just say something to give you time to think about it. The last question will be, I know we're not subject to a transfer window, but if you could sign one player, and I'm talking pragmatic player, in the transfer window, who would it be? Assuming Cabby's moved on the way, who would you sign? But yeah, it's got to be like one that's realistic. We can't go for some bizarre World Cup star or anything along those lines. But in the meantime, any other business that anybody wants to bring up while you think of who you'd sign?
Yeah, I just want to say thank you to our listeners for listening to the six episodes or whatever we put out shamefully this year. I do apologize. We will do more for the 2023. I promise now we'll get a few.
Yeah, well,
few
we all more in. Paul, he's the only person who knows how to do the links.
Yeah, so I will promise that we will get together a lot more. But thank you very much for listening through the course of this year, anyway, for that. And yes,
and I'll make a promise that we will do one that people can come along to as well.
Yeah, we shall do that.
Alive with an audience of three. So we'll definitely do that. I want to mention that the club will be launching a supporters forum. They've been talking about it for a while, but it will be launched early in the new year to try and get a route in for supporters to be able to get questions and answers into the club on an informal basis. But there will be a formal structure based around it. So looking forward for that to happening in the new year. Daryl?
Player. Good one.
Or any other business?
No, I don't have any other business. I'm going to go for Nick Kabamba. From Barnet.
Barnet. Yeah, that's quite good.
Whether they want to let him go is another matter, but that's what I'd be looking at.
Yeah, when you look at the list of National League top scorers, there's Langstaff, of course, who's not going to be coming to Chesterfield. Mullin, who's not going to be coming to Chesterfield. McShane of Dorking is third. Kabamba is fourth. So McShane's a number 10, and we've got plenty of them.
Yeah.
So Kabamba on 12 goals is level with Ollie Palmer. So, that's bizarrely enough, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, equal ninth is Wrexham centre half.
Aaron Hayden.
From time to time, yeah. So, that's a sensible call, Kabamba. Paul?
I'd like to go for, and sending Jack Clark out on loan, I'm going to go for Ryan Colclough of Altrincham.
Oh, you nicked my player.
Sorry, Stuart. Oh, I'm so sorry.
God, I've got to look for somebody else now.
So sorry. purely because Cook's worked with him before at Wigan. So that's my argument that he'd come. And he is a useful attacking player that would fit into anywhere along in the three behind. And that's my my argument for going out to get him. Sorry, Stuart.
No, it's all right. It's all right.
Well, you can have the same one. You know, we're all mates.
He caught the eye, didn't he?
He did.
Would you consider McShane to be unrealistic?
Well, I think he's 32, isn't he? He'd be an 18-month type of thing. Yeah. But he does score a lot of goals, though.
Yeah.
He might want to get over the line. Do you know what I mean? He might be one of those players that you need, you know, when you sign.
An addition to a squad rather than
a single leader on his own.
Is he going to go full time at 32?
Well, I know.
Very much down.
Probably not.
He does score. He's actually 28, McShane. But and I only know that because I've looked. I don't know the date of birth of every. But to be fair, the goals that he scored, he's not one of these that has had a fantastic month. Is the longest spell he's had without scoring is 4 games.
Right.
He consistently scores, but he plays in a team that create chances. Which, Chesterfield are a team that, so it'd be a good addition, but you'd sort
it
of
fits
think,
in. Well, yeah.
Alternatively, alternatively, I suppose, and he's 31 now, is Marius at Bromley, who is probably the player that we should have signed from Kings Lynn when we went and signed the guy at Notts now.
Mitchell.
Oh, Mitchell.
Yeah, I think we got the wrong M, didn't we? Yeah. But, But he's 31, so he's another one who's going to be in just to help us over the line, really, which is perhaps the sort of player we need. I don't know.
But the thing is with Murray, he scored 8 goals this season. They're all in twos.
We need players like that then, don't we?
We've only got one player who's done that this season. Yeah. You play him for a game, leave him out. Play him, leave him out, don't you? And he scores 2 goals in the games that he played.
Yeah, but the last goals he scored were the two against Chesterfield in when we won 3-2 in October.
Right.
So not on a great run, but he was the pick of the player because of course Whittle was in the same Kings Lynn team at that time as well, I think, wasn't he? And he was creating a lot of ammunition for Marriott. All sorts of and it is only rumours and everything about Shimanga and Stockport and everything along those lines. Would you do a swap for Paddy Madden?
Yes.
Yeah,
interesting.
I'd go for that. I'd be happy with that.
The other one I heard.
Yeah, Madden impressed me for Stockport last season playing here.
Yeah,
yeah.
The other one thrown about the other day, and this may be completely left field, was a return for one Armand Nandoulet.
Funny enough, I was talking about him earlier on today. Not in that context. It was the other day at the kids' party, which I mentioned earlier on, when Quigley and Grimes were asked for their favourite players, and I recounted the story when Nandoulet signed, and he only spoke French, so he came with a French teacher from St Mary's School who came alongside with a nun. It's the only time I've ever been in with a nun. And he's doing all his answers in French, and the teacher's translating them in an absolute sterling job. But then somebody sort of says, what sort of player do you like and model yourself on? And he's going on in French, and you just heard in the middle of a French sentence, Andy Carroll. But it was all right. You didn't translate that. We got that.
Yeah.
So he's playing in France again, isn't he?
Le Mans,
back in France. Le Mans or somewhere like that. Yeah. So he could race very quickly, beer in 24 hours. But certainly the Belgian Spyrites will be very happy with them. They're over for the West Brom game. 9 of them coming from Brussels.
Good.
For the West Brom game. So I know that because I fetched the tickets today. So, they booked on the plane, and Ryanair, I think, are going on strike that day. So they've had to go and find a 9-seater van.
I mean, they could come in Armand's 24-hour truck, couldn't they?
Well, they were great friends with Armand. He had some sort of cordial drink that he absolutely loved that he couldn't get in England, and every time they came over, they brought some with them. So they had a bit of a bromance going on with Armand and the Belgian Spyrites.
Well, it's inevitable he'll be back then.
Well, yeah. I'm sure they're keeping in touch with him. But yeah, that'd be all right. I'd settle for that.
Byron Harrison. Byron Harrison.
Yeah, I wouldn't settle for that.
What, he was a replacement for Owen Doyle?
Colclough, McShane, Madden. Who was the other one? We had
Kabamba.
Yeah, any of them would do. I'd take any of them. They'd all improve the squad. That's for sure. But like you say, you just think there's going to be people go out on loan. Clark has got nowhere near, has he, lately? Oh. And you need to make sure that he's fully fit before you do want to make a commitment to put him into the first 11. So, and Shackleford, just not because King's playing so well. Now, King is on 8 bookings in the National League, so he's 2 more bookings away from a ban. I think we've got one player on 4. It's the 23rd game against Scunny. So that makes the 5 go up to 10.
Right.
So I'll just have a quick look down my bookings page, which you can't always tell when everybody, the referees, but Oldacre's on 4. I thought Dobber had gone up to 4, but...
3, isn't he? Plus 1 in the cup.
Yeah, he's on 3. Dobber's on 3. So there's only Oldacre up for a 5th booking before the end of the 23rd game. But King has got another... it's not the final 23 to get 2, but he's going to get another suspension, which will be a 2 game. He won't not get 2 more bookings before the next deadline, will he? That's for sure. But one of the amazing things is Joe Quigley's not had a single yellow card yet, with all the physical battles he gets in, which shows that he's the injured party rather than the guilty party.
Yes,
most of the time, isn't he? So there's Oldacre on 4, and then Mandeville's on 3, Banks is on 3, Williams, Dobber on 3, Grimes is on 3. And for Grimes to have played every minute of every match and only be on 3 yellow cards is a great testimony to him as well.
Yeah.
For a centre back, yeah.
So there we go. So, right, we got not much any other business, which we did that. We said our bit. So it comes to me to wish everybody a happy new year, a successful new year personally, more importantly, as far as this podcast is concerned, for Chesterfield Football Club, Paul Cook and the guys. We will be back in the new year, as Paul's promised. But thanks for listening. Been a nice, super long one today. So well done to you all. Might be listening to it on your way to Wheelstone or something like that. And we'll be back in the new year, hopefully, talking about who we've drawn in the fourth round of the Cup. Hold it, 'cause this podcast's for you.
And if you like this podcast, then don't forget to subscribe. Please rate and review us on Spotify, Apple, and Google Podcasts, and many of your favorite podcast providers.